Hey, everybody, it's Scott Brennan here, and you're listening to the 150th episode of the Verbal Shenanigans podcast. And I take a little reflection. I look back and I say, wow, and 150 of these. And I look back to just the amount of passionate and unique and thoughtful and thought-provoking and people who just have amazing experiences to share that we have gotten to talk to. I've talked to some people I grew up listening to or watching, or it just really is amazing that the podcast has come from this little stupid show I did in front of a computer with no microphones to, like, you know, bringing Burlu along and getting some equipment and even bringing some sponsors around. And it's just a really cool feeling, and I hope to bring you 1,500 more episodes over the next couple of years, you know. So thank you for listening, and thank you for supporting the podcast and sharing it and recommending guests and things like that. We really do appreciate it. Now, I really appreciate a lot of the sponsors that have, I appreciate all of them. That doesn't sound right. I appreciate all the sponsors that really do believe in the show, you know, give it a chance, and that have joined on with us. And, you know, it's all sponsors that mean something to me. Trivia Revolution. Okay. Fueled by craft beer each week. We host trivia all throughout the state of New Jersey, different bars, restaurants, breweries. And each week you win prizes to New Jersey breweries and prizes to bar. I host at Tap House 15 on Wednesdays. I do trivia on Wednesday nights. Even if you're in last place, you could win. Okay, so Trivia Revolution, find them. Okay, check them out and support them. Local business. And then you think about some of the things we've been able to do, like Susan Robb is another one of our sponsors, from Toronto, Canada. So we go from Jersey to Canada. She lives out her mission to inspire others. Susan is a client partner for the Center for Leadership Studies. So if you heard that podcast a few weeks ago with Sam Shriver, which is the original home of situational leadership. If you want to learn more about how you build your leadership capacity, contact her at susan.robb@situational.com. She places equal effort and passion to inspire others as a speaker agent to some very cool people around the world, some of whom you've definitely heard on this show: Paul Templer, Bob Rathbun, Coach Jim Johnson, you name it. Okay, she's given us a lot of interesting guests, and she's been a really big help to the show, and we are glad to support her. Now, last week we spoke with Susan and then Kim Ward, okay, of 90 North Media, as Kim and Paul prepared for their trip to Nepal and trek to the Himalayas with Gary Goler, the first man in history to summit Everest with one arm. So stay tuned. Next week we'll maybe get a little update of them in Nepal and see if they made it. So that is Susan Robb, and we're very glad to have her. I am lucky enough to be very involved in the craft beer community. By very involved, I don't mean like I drink all day and say that I'm involved. Involved meaning that I pay attention to it and get involved with different releases and events, and I've always been akin to it. I used to brew a lot, plan to again. But I have three breweries that mean a lot to me that also believe in the podcast. The first one is Manskirt Brewing, and that's located in Hackettstown, New Jersey. So go check out Manskirt on Main Street on the old bank building. It's just a really cool setup, really cool murals. They got about 8 taps, seasonally inspired ales. They're always doing something new. Their bottle releases are 2 weeks away. They just released H-Town Hells and their Maybach Common Denominator. Their California Common. They had an event in Jersey. They have an event in Jersey City on June 3rd at the Jersey City Beer Fest. Okay, so they got a lot of different things going on. Go check Joe Fisher out in his Manskirt Brewing. The other one in New Jersey is Demented Brewing, located in Middlesex, New Jersey. If you've ever been to Demented, they have stepped their game up over the years and become one of the best places to visit in Jersey. Amazing tap room, 16 different beers going sometimes. Sundays, they're always releasing something new. They always have events and different cool things going on in the brewery. They won number one brew in Jersey from a local paper. So it pretty cool. They just released Phantom, their new pale ale brewed with Montueca and El Dorado hops. And this coming Sunday, they'll be releasing Vulcan, their mango habanero IPA. Mug clubs are back on sale for $25 for the remainder of the calendar year. Demented Brewing. Okay, and finally, Adirondack Brewery, which I'm super happy to have on board, was always my favorite place to visit. And it's just cool to, like, combine two things in your life that mean a lot. They are located right in Lake George, New York, right there on Canada Street, right by Lake George. It's beautiful. Go check it out this summer. They got a great deck area to sit at, great beers. They got new lunch and dinner specials now available at the pub. They got sweet and spicy salmon, raspberry and chipotle glaze, and chicken bacon ranch flatbread. Oh, my God, I haven't eaten yet, so I don't even like reading this right now. Limited space is available for the second annual Adirondack Brewery Cornhole Tournament. Join us on Saturday, June 3rd, for their second annual Cornhole Tournament with Ward Boards and New York Cornhole. Registration is about $40 per two-person team. Is $40 per two-person team included. Your first beer. Teams can be registered at www.nycornhole.com. Don't type that wrong. You might get something weird. But nycornhole.com. I'm about to sign up and tear that place up. Represent Jersey. But Adirondack Brewery, so glad to be part of them. Them to be part of us, I guess, would be the word. I guess it's a mutual thing. It's a relationship. They wash my back, I wash theirs, or something like that. But all our sponsors, thank you for believing in the podcast, and I hope this goes another 20 years. So this, today on the episode, we got a really cool episode. We have an underwater crime scene investigator and somebody from driveatank.com. I'm going to let you listen to it and get all the details on those two things. It's absolutely amazing. Guys, thank you for your support, as always. And please enjoy the podcast. Love you.
Okay, this is Mike Berry with Underwater Criminal Investigators, and you're listening to Verbal Shenanigan.
Hey, this is Tony Borglum from driveatank.com, and you're listening to Verbal Shenanigans, where we're going to crush things with a tank.
But our shenanigans are cheeky and fun.
Yeah, I mean, his shenanigans are cruel and tragic.
Which makes them not shenanigans at all, really.
Evil shenanigans.
I swear to God, I'll pistol whip the next guy that says shenanigans.
Okay, we are back. Welcome, everybody, to another thrilling episode of the Verbal Shenanigans Podcast. Verbal, since we're doing this the second time, you know what today is.
I'd like to phone a friend.
Yes.
I believe you brought up it is the 150th episode.
150 episodes. 50 seems just like it was yesterday. Where you brought, like,
balloons,
and we had every guest call in.
Yeah, when Dollar Tree was annoyed at us for about 3 months.
That was 100 episodes ago. 100.
Wow, that's... After you say it was 100 from now, it's like, wow.
Now it's clicking. The 150 didn't mean anything, but now...
No, that, you just... Because every week we're like, 142, 143, and then all of a sudden it's like, oh, 150. It's been 100 since that one.
Once I broke it down, that 100...
Yeah.
That 150 is 100 more than 50.
Yeah.
You were like, okay, this is
like,
crazy.
If you said 50 times 3, Berlu, I'd be like, oh!
But yeah, 150 of these...
attempts at humor.
Yeah, attempts at keeping people interested.
Entertain.
Yes.
Yeah.
But yeah, we're back again. We're coming off last week interviewing a very giant man. Mm-hmm. And we're also interviewed a transgender battle rapper. So
good stuff.
If this is the first episode you're tuning into, don't worry, today is right in line with that kind of variety and whatnot. But it's good to be back here.
Yeah.
No special like party for episode 150.
No.
That's not a number that you party like, I don't know. 50,
you don't party like a rock star.
You don't celebrate 150.
No.
200.
200, yeah, we're going to go freaking nuts.
Oh, we're going to go. We're going to buy like two cakes. We're going to tweet Dollar Tree like four times. But yeah, it's going to be wild. So just look out in a year for episode 200.
It's got to be nuts, man. We'll be in Hollywood with all the A-listers, bringing them on.
Yep. Curious, though, like I was thinking just this year, like from January to, I guess we're almost halfway through the year already. Kind of hard to believe that, really.
It's almost
June, but I was going to ask you, like, if there's an episode that stands out to you. Just like, we're not going down like a memory lane type episode, but I was just curious, like, I think that obviously this year has been
the guests have been pretty amazing.
Yeah, the best as far as consistency of guests. And we've also had, like, we've had big ones in there, but we've also had a lot of like smaller ones along the way. They're very interesting. But we've been doubling up almost every week lately.
Yeah, like, pretty much.
Like if you listen to this this, you'll find that the last like 10 episodes have been like two people usually. But I don't know if there was one that stood out to you.
The Chris Ballew one, yep. That was really fun. I got to say, I really enjoyed the President of the United States of America.
Yep.
I thought he was really fun, worked with us, had a good time. George Koronis, or that was cool, Lee Venture, right at the beginning of the year. I mean, that was just half the stuff he was coming up with. It's like, when you're the last story you can think of is like, yeah, I got bit by a bat in a cave, and I might get like straight up killed.
Yeah, yeah. I think that there's like three. There's more than three. I mean, they're all good, but I thought. The Kirby Chambliss one was one of my favorites. In fact, it's one of the ones I send, when I'm trying to get new guests, it's one of the ones I send on, because I think it was just a very, very good interview, and it's very unique, and he's, like, big, but we don't know him, so it was kind of, like, a different perspective, like, us interviewing a big guy, but we don't really know much about him.
You know?
And then I would say Victor Wooten and the Miller brothers were the other two that stand out for me.
I'm surprised you didn't say Dave Anderchuk.
Yeah.
I figured that'd be your top three.
Like, that's true, too. And there he is, everybody.
Obi, your favorite three. Go.
All the ones that I'm on.
Everyone,
he just, came from the vet. He got a nice three vaccines in the old asshole.
Oh.
So he's probably a little sore and out of it a little bit. But
the yearlies?
The yearlies, yeah. The yearlies, $250 down the drain. Dave Anderson, I don't know. I guess there really isn't one. It's hard to narrow it down to one. The Miller brothers was cool because it was live. It was in person with them.
Mm-hmm.
So it was cool to sit down with the guests rather than hear them over the phone sometimes. But yeah, Andrew Tuck and Victor Wooten were pretty awesome. Victor Wooten was awesome because I didn't think we were going to get that much time with him. We had like 50 minutes with him.
He was just chilling in Iowa, you know.
Yeah.
Thank you for being so boring, Iowa, we can have a good interview.
Thank you, Iowa.
Yeah, I don't think if he was like a night over in Los Angeles or Vegas, he would have gave us that much time.
You know, it was pretty good, too, the Abigail.
I was saying that, Abby the astronaut.
She just, there's a documentary on Netflix now, The Mars Generation. She's in it. So if anybody wants to check that out, I haven't watched it yet, but it looks good. It's a documentary all like young kids learning science and space exploration and stuff. So, check that out on Netflix. But
yeah. Coach Jim Johnson, that was pretty awesome.
Yeah, I mean, I can't really look at one that I was like completely like. Yeah, well, maybe one, but we'll keep that under wraps.
Oh, okay.
But yeah, it's good.
Let me try. I'll put up some numbers,
uh-huh.
And you just tell me yay or nay. Do you know the numbering, or do you need to bring up the...
I know the number.
All right. Let me look down.
There's only one.
Yeah. I'm going to go...
Yeah. Nope. Let me see. No. Say that again. Oh. Yeah. That one was okay. Yeah. That was on the lower side. But I was thinking this one. I know this is great for radio.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Yeah. Yeah, all right.
Yeah. But yeah, no one would ever be boring on this show.
No. Yeah. Nothing says excitement like phone tones, your washing machine making sex noises.
Listen, this is the house. This is how it goes.
We'll be barking.
But yeah, coming off, I got a phone call. I don't know who that is. Coming off a pretty crappy weekend weather-wise, but it's beautiful now. I feel awake. I cooked dinner before the podcast. That's always like that never happens. usually we're still going at like 8:30. I'm like, just order sushi. But right, so how is the unemployment going?
It's going along. I'm chugging along.
Bored yet?
It gets boring after a while. I mean, pretty much I have the consistent thing where I get up, I do like
At least you got that.
Yeah. I just lay in bed for 24 hours, and once in a while I come out for the podcast.
Use my bedpan.
Bedpan?
Oh.
Get up, do the general cleaning around the place, you know, picking up the clothes,
yep.
Doing the dishes, getting the coffee ready for the next day, stuff like that. Then I usually go to the library for a good 2 or 3 hours and just look up jobs and send out applications and go with there.
It's good you get out, too, because I feel like when you stay home, it just...
Yeah, the first 2 days I was doing that, and what basically made me change was I had to update something on the resume, and the girl has a Mac, which doesn't have a Microsoft Word license.
Right.
So I had to figure out somewhere, so I went to the library. It's like, oh, this is kind of nice, and they got a bunch of windows. You see some nature outside while you're doing stuff. Well, so it's like,
it's really advanced. It's got windows.
Yeah,
it's one of those,
those old libraries. Those four wall libraries, man.
It's a really great place. It's got windows, electricity.
Well, they also got this thing called a book. It's the most amazing thing. I tried to ask somebody to tell me how it works, but you know, they told me to shh.
I told you you had to know how to read in order to partake.
Yeah,
but so are you finding getting any hits?
Yeah, I should be getting an interview later this week. A couple other hits, but I've been finding stuff to send applications to and getting responses. So it's a lot better than earlier days of when I was searching for stuff. So.
Yeah, I mean, the internet is so, you know, you can hit on so many different things. And
yeah, the internet's great. Good analysis.
You have a field where you could, it can kind of dip its way into a lot of the IT can really, even if you're not like completely qualified, you could like at least get a hit and maybe get like in there and get trained, you know? Like,
exactly.
Because IT is very broad. Like the word IT, it could be like so many different things. Mm. But I was thinking that.
What do you do? It.
Yeah, I looked up jobs for weirdos.
Yay! Where do I apply?
I was thinking if you're thinking career change, here might be some of the things that you know you might be interested in.
All right.
Now we've done disgusting jobs before, or wacky jobs, or we've talked about jobs before. But here are some things that maybe in the meantime, might you need a couple bucks,
can do.
You want to be a snake milker?
Snake milker. Which side am I milking?
Snake milkers don't make much as a rule. It's the amount of venom they extract from the snakes that pays a generous amount. But it takes a lot of work and patience to get even an ounce from a snake. One interesting profile, Jim Harrison, he extracted venom from various snakes 1 million times. He does it barehanded, too. So if you... The snake milker, I like that you considered it and you thought it was milking something else, not the venom. Yeah. So you must be very desperate.
Hey, it's up there. There's nothing coming out of this rattle. It's weird. Man, this thing is getting pissed.
This reminds me of that scene from, what's the bowling movie with the...
Kingpin?
Yeah, where he's like... I milked a cow or whatever. I was like, we don't have a cow.
We have a bull. Oh, yeah.
All right. Well,
Woody Harrelson.
I wouldn't say. I don't think snake milk is for you. I can't imagine you.
I
with
can't
a snake.
See the market in New Jersey for snake milk.
Yeah. Yeah. Plus,
selling it on the side of the road, delicious snake milk.
Come get your delicious snake milk.
Nobody's come back to complain about it.
I just picture you in overalls, like twirling a fake snake around you. Like,
who know it? We got a deal on some snake milk here. We got 2%. We got skim, and we got whole, just for you. Yee-haw!
Put your snake milk in your eggs, snake milk in your coffee.
Mm, it's delicious.
Rub this snake milk on your head and you will have hair.
You have open wounds, snake milk does wonders.
Picture it like in a bag with like milk spelled M-E-L-K. Yeah. Snake milk.
With the E backwards.
Yeah, I can't see you like at dexterous enough to milk a snake. I feel like you'd bump into the snake thing and knock like all the snakes out, and it just
it's gotta happen again. Don't ask where Izzy's at.
Now here's a job I think.
Okay.
I think you fit the qualifications.
Oh,
a golf ball retriever.
Okay.
Golf ball retriever.
Is that like a golden retriever?
Florida golf clubs and golf courses in hot regions are a good place to work for this job. Alligators live in water traps and on golf courses, but there's money to be made there if you dare. Brave and crazy people dive into the water to retrieve golf balls and golf clubs. Not surprisingly, there are a lot of them down there. A Zimbabwean man was interviewed about the dangers of diving for balls and water traps. He replied, no man, it's daytime. The alligators are asleep. Large water snakes such as cottonmouth water moccasin also lurk beneath the shallow depths. That job doesn't pay a lot either.
Who was the guy who went at night for golf ball retrieving?
I guess he was asked at night.
Man, it's dark and it's painful.
No, but I think the alligators sleep in the day. So
I'm just saying it's like it's cool. I do it during the day. Yeah, when did you think we thought you were going to do it?
Unless like maybe when they're sleeping, they get disturbed easily. I don't know.
I can
see you. At first, I thought it was just like a golf ball retriever. Like you just run out and go get the ball. And bring
I
it
got
back,
it
like a lab.
You see me grab it. It almost went in this hole. I saved it.
I mean, a golf ball retriever. I think you can do it.
Doesn't look good on a resume, though. I don't.
No one said you put these jobs on a resume. This is just to get by, you know.
Because I update and put snake milker in there.
So tell us about your snake milking experience.
Let me tell you, it's the greatest experience I ever went through in my life.
There's the good old sperm donor.
Yeah. Been there, done that.
On yourself doesn't count as donating, could you do?
I just go into the bank and I hand over some tissues.
Could you do a sperm donation, like, and know that maybe you might have like another burlew walking around one day? That's not.
I wouldn't
really connect to
you. To it, but I mean, if it was like across the street or something, I'm not gonna go out of my way.
What if it paid well? What if like?
It paid well, sure, but I don't think those things really pay.
So it doesn't like creep you out that like maybe like some woman's using your juice to make some kids, and like one day you're at the you're at a store, and a guy's like reciting Dukes of Hazzard line like a little kid, and like wearing a Redskin hat, and he's like he's some awkward character in a play, and you're just like like scratching your head a little bit. Looking at him.
I'm teaching the ways of Coy and Vance. They weren't that bad, son. They had to do a job to keep the Dukes alive.
All right, what about a gumologist? People who chew and analyze gum. Yeah. They.
I like bubblish. Well, I get canker sores. I don't want to do that. Things you learn on the podcast.
They analyze the weight of the gum, the taste of the gum, how long it lasts, the way it feels in their mouth.
Okay. Mouthfeel?
Mouthfeel, yep. Gumologist. Here's a good one for you. Face feeler. You want to be a face feeler? Ever wonder how shaving brands and beauty things companies can claim their products give you the smoothest skin? Okay. Well, one lucky person has verified it for them. A face feeler tests how soft and smooth a person's skin is after using a product.
So I would be like to do the shaving commercial and the guy, you know, towels off his face and I'm the hand on the from the other side. You don't see the person's face and just like feeling him.
Yeah, but you might be more of like you might actually have to do this. Like,
yeah. So I'm the non-televised face feeler.
Right, yeah. Darn. You don't have hands for televised face feeling. You're more of a behind-the-scenes face feeler.
I guess that crooked finger right there. You got,
you got 40-year-old hands. They need nice, young, 22-year-old face feeling hands.
Well, old people shave. Come on now.
No, but you're not feeling your own face. You're feeling somebody else's.
Yeah.
Nobody wants your hands on their face.
I don't know. I'm very smooth with my skin.
Listen, the only time your hands go on people's faces is when they're soaked in chloroform.
I did a good job doing that.
They didn't pay, though. They never paid.
Yeah. I get mad and I call the police and I'm like, oops, I shouldn't have done
clown
that.
Clown manager.
Mm. Insane clown posse? Okay.
Clowns who make a professional living, and especially those who perform for places like Sick Kids Hospitals, need someone to book their performances, follow up their phone calls, and do a number of administrative tasks.
So I would just cold call people and just say, you want a clown?
When's the last time you had a clown or snake milk?
Hi. how's it going? I know it's 11:30 at night, but would you like a clown at your front door now?
What about a duck escort? A duck escort.
No, I don't want to have sex with a duck.
Duck escort, in the immortal words of Robert Ripley, believe it or not, there's a hotel in Memphis that has a person who escorts ducks to and from the lobby twice a day.
That's his full time. So they do it twice a day, but they need a full time.
He's also a former animal trainer, so maybe he like feeds them and stuff in the middle, and then brings them back out for their second performance. I actually seen this on TV once. Like they walk through the hotel and like come out, and like it's like a big thing.
Yeah, that's a weird Holiday Inn.
You could handle duck escort.
Yeah, probably.
Elevator inspector, professional sleeper.
I could probably do that last one.
You got to go to Helsinki though for that one. What else we got? An iceberg mover.
That sounds interesting.
A human scarecrow.
Like in like DC Comics.
A fake Facebooker.
A what?
Fake Facebooker.
Okay, what do I do?
Computer Wiz creates multiple fake accounts that can serve as a variety of purposes. So you'd be liking things and soliciting things as a
fake. That's how our numbers went up.
Yes. A bed warmer. You just warm. A staffer is outfitted in a white fleecy getup from head to toe, and you roll around in the bed for 5 minutes, and you leave them with toasty sheets.
Wow. People with money get some really weird things for them.
All right. Flatulence odor reduction underwear maker.
I would move the curve, if you will.
Chocolate engineer.
I'm down with that.
Crime scene cleaner. Roadkill removal specialist.
Well, I took a selfie with one once.
Vomit cleaner.
Yeah. No.
Coconut safety engineer.
I'd be down with that.
Now, I've given you a lot of options here. Knife thrower victim or assistant?
I'll throw them.
Oh, I'll throw them if you want to be the assistant. I mean, you got a lot of things here. Right? Yeah. Do any of these stand out to you or... Do they interest you?
I'm still wondering about the coconut thing at the end there.
Oh, let's just read that real
coconut quick. Engineer?
Coconut safety engineer. Coconut safety engineer, in order to protect strolling guests from accidents on their walkways, at resorts, employ people to pick ripe coconuts from palm trees before they fall.
I can be down with that. I mean, I'd probably be in like Hawaii or Florida, just climbing trees all day.
Just taking down coconuts?
Yeah.
So you would think the coconut safety engineer is the one that stands out?
I could see me doing that, like, you know, even to like my 70s, you know.
See, like, that's what I think. Like, I was talking to Alex today, or no, I was talking to Jeff, a guy at work today, and I was saying, you know, like, your job doesn't make who you are. If you can make a living taking down coconuts, who cares? And like, you work a normal hours.
I don't care
if the paycheck's there. You know, like, we put too much into like what we actually do for a living. Like, who cares what I do for a living?
Mm-hmm.
If I'm a face feeler or a snake milker, that's what I do, bro. Like, I milk snakes.
Yeah, that's all I do. all day, every day, snake.
I escort ducks from point A to point B.
Yeah,
that's it.
Who else is going to do it, huh?
So, all right. So a coconut. Oh, maybe we can get a coconut safety engineer on the show.
I'd be down
to talk to us. But I have a feeling they're probably like local guys that like make a couple bucks.
Mm-hmm. Nothing where you kind of have that side job thing going.
Yeah. All right. So, good luck, buddy. Good luck. Maybe we can get some of these guys on.
I'll be coming to Stanley, a job near you.
Stanley Cup keeper.
Ooh.
But I think there's only one guy that does it.
Why is this cup all dented up? The Predators are so pissed off right now.
I think the Pantera threw the Stanley Cup off the roof of a building.
I heard something like that. Something like that.
I think we got to move to guest time.
Ooh.
Don't do it.
No?
Don't do it.
But that would be my profession, you know,
jingle singer upper.
Okay. Upperer.
Right. So we got.
I won the full title. coming up here, Scotty, we're going to be talking with Mike Barry. He is the owner and one of the trainers at Underwater Criminal Investigators LLC. And we're going to be chatting with him on what it's like to work underwater and work with the police on helping out with crime scenes.
Have you ever, has anybody ever been killed by snake milk and thrown?
Does the snake milk evaporate in the water?
I'm just going to beat that joke, the snake milk idea, into the ground, by the way. Mike Berry, here we go.
Hello.
Hey, is this Mike?
This is Mike.
Mike Berry. This is Scott Brennan and Mike Berlew from Verbal Shenanigans. How you doing?
Doing good. How are you guys doing?
You're keeping right in line with being an underwater crime scene investigator. Is that the proper terminology for your job?
That's what I do. I'm an underwater criminal investigator. I do underwater crime things.
So you only investigate underwater criminals, like, you know,
The snorks.
The snorks, the bad guy from The Little Mermaid.
Oh, yeah.
I wish it was that easy.
Okay. So, first off, what exactly, you said your title, but what is the day-to-day work life for you? Is this a full-time gig? Is this a whenever they call you kind of thing?
I do this full time. I travel around the country into other countries and teach other public safety divers how to do this. But when you think about it, you know, when you have a crime and there's evidence relating to that crime, a lot of that evidence ends up in the water. Either someone throws a murder weapon off of a bridge, or they drive the car off of a boat ramp and try to get rid of it, or, you know, the safe. I mean, it's unlimited, and it's unlimited to someone's imagination. Whatever they can steal or take or, you know, is used in a crime, and they want to get rid of that piece of evidence. You know, the water is just a perfect place in their mind to get rid of it. And so they slow down or they stop the truck and drop it in, never knowing or never believing that there are people that are trained to go down and search for it.
Okay. Where do you start with a position like that? Do you have to actually get like a degree in crime, or does it actually start from being a diver?
It usually starts with joining a team. So you're either part of a law enforcement team, a fire department, rescue team. And, you know, a lot of the departments around the country, public safety departments, also have dive teams. And the dive teams can either do rescue where someone, you know, drowns and they make an attempt to rescue the person, or they do recovery work, which is things are slowed down and they get their, you know, a little time later and they try to do a recovery and find it. Now, some teams do both. They do rescue and they do recovery. But it all starts with joining usually a public safety department and then joining their team that they have one, a dive team if they have one.
Now, when did you start this and how long have you been doing it? And like, how do you start getting into like crime underwater? I'm guessing you have to have scuba experience and diving experience and all that. When did it switch over to either looking for objects or people or things or what? There's a lot I'd like to ask you, but let's go to the beginning here.
Yeah, I was a scuba diver before I joined the police force. And when I joined my department, I had no idea that they even had a dive team. And this was back in 1980. And so when I joined, you went to the academy for a week. You had to qualify. That was the big thing. You had to qualify with your weapon, and then you did what was called probating. So you look like a trooper because they dressed you like a police officer, and you went out somewhere in the state and rode with a real police officer, and you waited for an academy to start. Well, I happened to ride with a scuba diver for my department. And one day he just asked me out of the blue, do you scuba dive? And I said, yes, I do scuba dive. And he says, well, we're going tomorrow with a couple of sheriff department divers. We're going to go look for some stolen handguns that were thrown into a pond. And he asked me if I'd like to go. And I said, yes, I would like to go. And so I drove north and to my parents' house where all my scuba gear was stored. And I grabbed it and came back the next day. And I went scuba diving in this pond with a real police diver. And he told me what to do. He told me they were working on this grid pattern. And one diver was on one side and I was going to be on the other. And we held hands while we were on this, following this rope. And we moved along the bottom, searching what was in our path. And we talked to each other by squeezing each other's hands. And so I got a quick crash course in how to do that. And out of that operation, my hand hit a handgun. And I found a handgun, and I squeezed the right number of squeezes to my partner. So we made a recovery, and out of all the divers that day, I was the only one that made a recovery. And so here I was. I wasn't really a policeman yet. I had all these police divers pat me on the back, and, you know, and I knew right then what I was going to do for the rest of my life. I loved diving. I knew I wanted to do that. And here I was combining diving with police work and actually helping somebody using your diving skills. And so I set out on a mission that that's what I was going to do. And so as soon as I graduated from the academy, I joined their dive team. And then a few years later, I became an instructor. And I learned a lot from the old divers, the ones that just kind of grew up doing it and showing me how to do it. And then it evolved to where I was asked to teach others. And after I became an instructor, I started doing that. I started teaching other people how to do it, and then it just kind of grew from there.
That's amazing.
Wow.
That's amazing. I was just curious, like, you went on this before you became an actual police officer. Now, when you went through the mm-hmm. academy, was it like did they know that you were a diver and that you would kind of be put right into that, or was that just had to do the same thing that everyone else did and then you kind of had to find your way?
I was just one of the in the number of trainees, right. And you're like the lowest form of life while you're going through the academy. So you first have to survive that. And when I did, I was assigned to an area. I was assigned to Fredericksburg, Virginia. And so I went there to work. And then I waited for an opening to come up for the dive team. And I saw a letter come out advertising that they were looking for divers, and I put my name in and went out for the tryouts and then joined the team.
Wow. Let me ask you, when you're doing these dives, we always watch like CSI and whatever, where they say you can't disturb this crime scene or do anything different. Do you have to like take pictures down there, or can you just, like, if you find some kind of evidence, bring it up?
Yeah, that's a very good question. It's an area that confuses a lot of people. You know, when you look at a land crime scene, you know, let's say someone kills somebody and, you know, the body's laying there and they, you know, take the gun outside and for some reason they decide, you know, I got to get rid of this, and they throw the gun in the backyard. Well, when you look at that crime scene, you know, you've got the crime and the evidence, you know, in the house, and then it transfers, you know, outside, and now it's in the backyard. And you know, if that gun is discovered, you know, laying in the backyard, the question is, you know, what do you do with it? And when you ask a trained police officer, you certainly don't walk up and just pick it up. There's so many things that have to be done. And these are rules of evidence. It's rules that have been established over years and years of court cases and trials and training. And now it's all dictated. It's all standardized, where there's a set procedure to get that piece of evidence into court. It has to be done right, and it has to be done by, you know, highly trained, certified investigators. And so they have a set procedure to, you know, to search for it, to, when they discover it, to mark it and to photograph it, to triangulate it, to document it, and the way they pick it up, the way they package it, the way they handle it, the way they process it, all of that is well established. And all of that is done in a certain way so you could actually use it.
It's very interesting. It's like what I was thinking is like, like your first one where you were saying you weren't even part of the force, but yet you found a handgun. I guess is it hard to like, not like, I guess you're so experienced, but I feel like if I found something, I'd pick it up and be like, hey guys, look what I found. Like if I did that, can that like literally ruin that piece of evidence?
It could. The question, when you touch it, you're possibly contaminating it. You're possibly getting rid of fingerprints or trace evidence or biological evidence. The other question is control, is who actually had possession and control of it. And so all of that has to be, you know, well documented in order for this to you know, go through court. And so the question is, when it comes to underwater, and this is the thing that confuses a lot of people, and it's departments all over the country, the question is, where does it say that the rules change when it comes to evidence when that piece of evidence goes underwater? Why would you treat that piece of evidence that's underwater differently than the evidence that was laying in the field or in the house?
Right.
And the answer to the question is the rules don't change. You still have to have highly qualified, certified investigators, but these investigators work underwater, and that's where underwater criminal investigators come into play. And so there's, you know, the first, you know, hard part is finding it. And so that search component of your operation, you know, that could take days. You might get lucky, it might take, you know, hours. But once you find that item, you know, once your hand hits it, once your brain says, I've got it, you're in the most sensitive part of the recovery right at that moment. What you do next can screw it up, or you could become the hero. And so that's where that training comes into play, because it's sort of like your eyes saw it in the field. You know, now what are you going to do with it? And it's the same thing underwater. Usually we're diving in zero visibility. And so when I say your hand hits it and your brain says, I've got it, that's usually how it works. Is we find targets, most of our targets, by feel. And so, you know, when your brain says you've got it, you've got to be trained to put it back down, to stop touching it, because you can do harm to that evidence. And it takes training and practice to get to that level where, you know, you're right at that point where the moment you realize you have the target, you put it back down, and then you do the right thing next.
Amazing. When you're underwater, how long are you generally underwater trying to search for items? And I guess the second part is, considering certain times of the year, are you only allowed a certain amount of time underwater if it's like below freezing or anything like that?
Yeah, that's a good question. You know, it does depend different times of year, and it's so involved when it comes to, you know, the training and the equipment that's involved. And so, you know, when you just look at diving in general, you know, you have, you know, there's rules. There are time limits based on your depth. And so the air that you're breathing, you know, it's a mixture of oxygen and nitrogen, and you have limits. You have limits, nitrogen limits. And so we follow certain tables, and those tables tell us, you know, how long we can stay down at certain depths. So you have to follow that.
Right.
And then when you're dealing with, you know, not just temperatures, but what's in the water, you know, most of our waterways have some level of contamination in it. And so you have to be protected from that. And so not only does the water column have it, but then you get down on the bottom in the silt, and there's all kinds of things in that silt waiting for you. And that's where you're operating, is on the bottom. And so as you're searching and your hands stirring it up, you can be exposing yourself to very harmful things. And so you have to be protected from that. And all that takes training. So you have to have special suits. That takes training. You know, special masks. That takes training. You know, it's very complicated and very dangerous. And that's where, you know, to have a well-established, trained, professional team, it takes a lot of time. It takes a lot of money, unfortunately. But what you're trying to do is not only succeed, but you're trying to survive. And you're trying not to hurt anyone while you're trying to solve, you know, the problem. And so, you know, the cold temperature, you know, your body can only take so much, even in a well-insulated or a dry suit. You know, you can go under the ice with these special suits.
Right.
You know, but eventually you start getting, you know, very cold. So what a lot of teams do is they limit your time down there just because they know that the diver loses focus after so many minutes underwater while he's trying to, you know, work that environment.
It's amazing. It really is. Now, does every police department have one of these teams, or is it like groups of counties or by state? Like, how does that work?
A lot of your large departments have teams. A lot of your, but not all. And so it just depends. You know, you have volunteer teams. So you have, these are just, you know, people that have other jobs that volunteer for their county or the city.
Right.
And they create their own dive teams. And then you have paid units. So you have paid police, paid fire, paid rescue. And so they're getting paid while they're doing it. And then you look at those teams, and, you know, the teams might have different missions. So there might be a rescue team. There might be a recovery team. There might be a team that does both. And then you look at those, and then some have a little bit of training. Some have very little training, and some have all kinds of training, and then some have the right equipment, some are lacking in equipment. You know, it's just, there's so many variations out there, and there's so many different environments and missions and depth, you know, for what might be needed, you know, in New York, for example, you know, and you take, you know, all of that, the training and the equipment, and then you go to California, to San Diego, and they do it totally different. You know, you go to Hawaii, or you go to Texas, or you go to, you know, Oregon. You know, they all have different environments, different missions, different, you know, problems, different depths. And so, you know, they all kind of tweak it toward their operation, and with the focus of being very safe and not hurting anybody, and also being successful.
Now, I have to ask, obviously we've been talking about recovering, you know, different objects from the water. Have you had to go in search of, like, missing people or anything like that? And how does that change the search?
Yeah, your three cores for underwater criminal investigation, which is really recovery, what's called recovery diving, is body recovery, vehicle recovery, and evidence recovery. And evidence can be anything. It can be handguns, a safe, a cash register. It could be a pocketbook. It could be anything connected to a crime. And there's a land investigator that wants it. That his investigation. That's really what we're doing, is we're carrying on a land investigator's case. His case his case led him to the water's edge. And so he's standing there looking out into the water, and his evidence, his case is out there. And so he's calling you because you're an underwater criminal investigator. Unfortunately, you know, a lot of them don't have a real underwater criminal investigator. So they have a dive team. They have, you know, guys that, you know, have scuba gear, and they train, or they focus on the rescue end of it. And then they're called in, and they don't really have the training that's needed to really carry on his criminal investigation. So those are the three core bodies. And you look at bodies in general, it could, it's unlimited. So it could be a person that drowned. It could be, it could be accidental. It could be suicide. The person could be weighted down. That's like in a homicide. They weight the person down to hold them down so that they don't come to the surface. Or it could be a suicide where they weight themselves down so they don't chicken out. That's usually why they're doing it, is they don't want to, you know, chicken out and try to make it to the surface. And so... So they could also be in different states of decomposition. So, you know, it could be a recent drowning and the body's still in good shape, or it could be, you know, a cold case and the body's been down for 10 years.
Jeez.
And so you're no longer looking for a body. You're looking for a skeleton, and you're looking for clothing, and you're looking for teeth, and you're looking for jewelry. And so it changes, and they could be in... They could be in a 55-gallon drum. They could be wrapped up in a rug. They could be in a tarp with chains and center blocks. I mean, it's just, it's unlimited. And so every one of those cores has the same thing. So vehicle, it could be accidental. It could be on purpose. It could be insurance fraud. It could have bodies. It could not have bodies. It could have drifted away from the boat ramp, and now you have to have lift bags and... so a tow truck can't reach it, so it gets a little complicated in how you got to lift it to the surface and tow it to where a tow truck can get to it. And so, you know, you look at your evidence. It could be something big. It could be small. It could be a handgun. It could be a handgun broken into all its little parts and springs thrown in different places. I mean, it can get crazy.
Yeah. I mean, I can't even imagine what you've seen over time. But I was thinking when you were saying, like, when we were talking about the bodies and whatnot. Now, let's say there's a missing person,
right.
And we've seen on TV where they investigate, you know, they got scuba divers and boat teams and stuff like that, and they're looking and looking and looking. Now, I guess as the guy who's in charge of something like that or is doing that, are you one... Are you almost happy when you don't find something that there's, you know, there could be a chance that this person is alive and on shore or, you know, not found yet? And the other question leading into that was, how long would you do an investigation until it's like called off, and who makes that decision?
Yeah, those are great questions. The, you know, you always hope for the best.
Right.
You know, but usually when we get a call, not always, you know, quite often though, they know the person's in there, but not always, you know, there could be missing people. We get calls where, like an Alzheimer's patient, you know, has wandered away from the house and
half a mile
away, there's a pond. And so there's no evidence saying that he's in the pond, but they want the pond searched. So in cases like that, you're searching it, you know, just to say yes or no. And then when you say no, then they know, you know, he's not in the pond. He's still in the woods, or they go other places to search. So there's a lot of searches like that where you're searching and you're really just trying to rule it out. But on the other side of it, there's a lot of cases where, you know, for a fact, I mean, you know, the family was right there when he drowned. And so there's all these witnesses. And so, you know, many cases are like that. And or it could be where the killer or his accomplice says, you know, this is where the body was dumped. Now, you're hoping they're telling the truth, but quite often they don't tell the truth. And they had no intentions of telling you where they put the body, but you have to go search anyway because you have an investigator, and that's where his case led, and he needs to know yes or no. And so when you're tasked with that, you know, what you're trying to do is answer that question, you know, 100%. Right. You know, is the item, you know, in there, yes or no? And it's called clearing, and that takes a lot of training to actually clear an area. So if the area has been cleared, that you're saying beyond a shadow of a doubt that the item wasn't within your search area. And so that could, you know, that's from a gun to a car to a body. So
I guess it's like a fine line between wanting to find something and not wanting to find something. I guess it's like a fine line. Like, I guess if you're on a case and all that, you finding something is extremely beneficial, but sometimes you not finding something could, like, I don't know, be like a chance of hope. You know, it's kind of a crazy idea to think about.
No, you're exactly right. Is that it leaves other possibilities open that, you know, they could still be, you know, alive. That, you know, it's so you're right. And but, you know, with the body down there, the truth is you're trained to where you're trying to make the recovery. And it's like with a body, you're trying to make the recovery, for one, out of respect for the victim. You know, they're down there, you know, hoping someone comes down and recovers them, but also for closure for the family. I mean, there's no closure for the family until, you know, their loved one can be brought back. Then they can begin that healing process. And so you look at what you're asked to do. It's not just solve a case, but, you know, a lot of these cases with, you know, victims involved, you know, you're actually getting involved in the emotion of what's happening, the reality of what's happening to some family. Yeah. You know, jeez. One minute you're involved with your own family, and the next minute you're right there with another family that's grieving and hoping, you know, that through your search skills, your diving skills, and your knowledge, that you can bring some closure to this.
Now, also as a trainer, when you're teaching others to do like an investigation of a body, are you do you lean more towards the strictness of, okay, this is a crime scene, we have to be very specific, you got to keep it in line, or do you also have to balance the emotional thing of somebody dealing with, if they do this job, they have to face death in that scenario?
Yeah, that's something that is taught. You know, because it does take a toll on your divers. And, you know, I've written a few books, and one of the things I talk about in one of them is, you know, you never know. You can be trained. You know, you can sit there and listen to someone like me talk about it and teach you how to do it and teach you the steps to stay in control and what it looks like. And I can show you pictures and just teach you all kinds of stuff from basic to advanced body recovery. But you really don't know if you have it in you until you're underwater and you touch a body for the first time and get involved in one. And that's like the moment of truth. And I've seen over the years, I mean, you look how long I've been doing it. I've been doing it for 35 years. And so I've seen a lot in those 35 years, and I've seen divers after touching a body underwater come up screaming, and we actually have to rescue them. Wow. I've seen them
stay in control.
That would
be me, for sure. Yep.
I've seen them stay in control and do their job, but afterwards they quit.
That's what I was wondering about. I was wondering about the after effects. Like, you've seen you. I mean, we haven't even gotten into, like, what you've seen. I'm sure it's amazing, the possibilities of what you've seen. But dealing with it and compartmentalizing and keeping it into hey, that was work, and this was my job, I was doing my duty, and this is what happened, mm-hmm. and not taking it home and into you sit down to watch the baseball game and not think about it. You know, I can't imagine that. And do you have a do you have like a strategy or something that you personally do to leave that at work?
You know, the blessing I've always had, and I'm a God-fearing Christian man, and honestly, I believe that this is what I was meant to do, and it's a gift for me, because I do a lot of praying before. I do praying during, and I certainly pray after, and I've prayed with the families before, but the truth is, I'm just being honest. It doesn't bother me because I look at it differently. I truly look at it when I'm down there searching for them, and when I find them, I truly look at it as I'm there to help them. I'm there to bring closure. I'm there to bring them back. Mm-hmm. I'm doing something for them, and I'm doing something for their family. So I don't look at it as this scary thing, this dead body. You know, I don't look at it that way. I look at it as a person. And there's a person down there. You know, I might not have known him, but his name is, you know, might be John. And I know his name is John, and I'm looking for John. And when I find John, you know, I'm grabbing John. So I look at it differently than some people do. Some people, it's scary, and that's not how they look at it. It's them, and it's dark, and it's cold, and there's, you know, a dead person down there. It's almost like going into a haunted house, I guess. And so it does.
Not for me. Spooky. Not for me, I'll tell you.
It's not for everybody.
Berlo, Mike, you're looking for a job. Are you looking for like an intern at all?
I'm more looking for the people. It's like, I lost my car keys down there. Can you help me out?
Because I got a guy. He's a great intern. Just.
But that's kind of interesting. I was like, on the side, when I looked at his at your signature, how you're a Christian-owned company, I was kind of going to get into, when you see some of the most horrible things I can imagine, is it hard to be a devout Christian when you see such horrible things in life?
You know, it kind of comes with your faith. You know, there's good and evil, and I'm around the evil like so many other law enforcement and other public safety people. We're, you know, we kind of live with that and deal with that evil side all the time. And so, you know, I've been fighting that side for a long time. And so, unfortunately, this is part of it. And so, you know, but not all of them have, you know, the people have been, you know, killed or anything like that. A lot of them is just an accident and you know, someone lost their life or whatever. But, you know, you look at all the cases, you know, from a murder case to a drive-by or, you know, stolen car to, you know, a killing. You know, there's so much misbehaving in the world. You know, there's so much stuff going into the water. People like me will unfortunately be in business for a long time.
All right, let's get to the question that I'm sure you've been asked a million times. There's got to be one or two or three most interesting items you've either found or been sent down to find. Give us something.
Well. Some of those things I can't talk about.
Oh, okay.
They're not sensitive. The biggest honor I had was to lead the FBI anthrax diving operation. Jeez. So that goes down in my book as one of the biggest honors I had was.
So what was it? Was looking for anthrax that was dumped?
Looking for evidence relating. That was related to that case. Huh. Their case led to Frederick, Maryland, and some frozen ponds, and I was brought in to lead the diving operation. So that definitely, you know, was one of the highlights of my career. I also got to dive and try to recover evidence in the Virginia Tech situation.
Wow. Okay. Yeah.
And so I've had some, you know, pretty big important cases, and I look at them all as honor because they were, you know, terrible victims, and then you're being asked again to come and try to help and try to, you know, solve the case or bring closure to it. And
now,
so I've done that.
Go ahead. Sorry.
But, you know, when you ask one of the weirdest, I can give you one of the weirdest. There's so much weird stuff underwater.
I can't even imagine.
Oh my gosh, just crazy things. But one time we were diving and we recovered this this little wooden box, and it was duct taped to a brick.
What? Okay.
And so we, you know, that's unusual. You got this little wooden box, just real, you know, simple wooden box. It was probably 5 inches by 5 inches, you know. And so, you know, we take pictures of it, and that's, you know, kind of unusual. So we cut the duct tape off and open up the box. And then the box is a bag, and the bag is all tied up. And so we take pictures of it, and we open up the bag. And we pour out the contents, and it's a voodoo doll.
Oh, man. creepy.
It's a voodoo doll with some candles and things, and there is a needle in the groin of the voodoo doll. So we took pictures, and I told everybody to be real quiet and to listen. And I pulled the needle out, and I said, somewhere there's a man saying, thank God.
You noticed it was your partner that finally ran to the bathroom. Like, what? Hey, what?
So that went down as an unusual find. You don't find them.
Ridiculously bizarre.
Every day.
Let me ask you something. If you're working with a teammate, now you're probably like one of the senior guys on set, but you're training someone, yeah, and one guy's left-handed, one guy's right-handed, and you communicate through hand thing, who wins that argument? Yeah.
It doesn't matter. You get used to using your hand. And it sort of looks like a golf grip. So if you look at a golf club and how you put your left hand and then your right hand and you intertwine your fingers, that's sort of how the grip looks on a particular search pattern. Not all search patterns are done that way, but the one we use quite often is called a jack stay, which is a grid line. Very methodical, very accurate pattern. And so that's how they talk. Now, you also have,
amazing,
you know, hardwire communication. You also have wireless communication. Oh. So you can use communication, but usually we use squeezes because, you know, if you're talking all the time with communication, your sense of feel, you know, disappears. And so you really don't want to be doing a lot of talking while you're searching. You're concentrating on finding a murder weapon or something like that.
Yeah, well,
you really have that sense of feel activated.
Because that was one of the questions I did want to ask you. You've been doing this for 35 years. One of the obvious things that has to change, as technology has definitely probably changed over the years as far as finding things.
Oh, let me tell you.
I can't even imagine what's out there now and how different it was 35 years ago.
You know, there's so many things out there. You know, we kind of call them toys, but they're very expensive. But boy, do they change your life. They increase the safety of your operation and the effectiveness of your operation. So I'll give you an example. One of the neatest things out there for me is a side scan sonar. And so before that device, you know, came out to where we could actually, you know, afford it and buy it, you know, the way we go for a body, you interview your witnesses, they point to where the person went under, and you start searching. So, you know, if that was in the middle of the lake, you know, that's looking for a needle in a haystack. And so you just set up search patterns, and you could be there for days you know, sending diver after diver, just day after day searching. And now with a side scan sonar, you come by that area in a matter of minutes. You see the person laying on the bottom, and you mark him and send a couple of divers down. Send a couple divers down, and the divers go straight down, grab him, come straight up. I mean, it's that simple. And so the technology has changed things dramatically. Unfortunately, technology isn't perfect. So depending on your bottom and your bottom composition, you know, like with side scan, it's not very good if you have a lot of obstructions like trees or stumps or boulders or grass. It can't see, so that kind of environment it's makes the target invisible. So you have to go back to the way, you know, you used to do it, is you send in divers and you try to clear the area that way. But definitely, technology has changed things. So you have side scan sonar, you've got ROVs, which are remotely operated vehicles, you've got toad detectors, metal detectors, proton magnetometers, underwater metal detectors. I mean, there's so many. Now they're coming out with devices that you put over your mask, and using a type of sonar, you actually can see, even in zero visibility. It sends the signal out in front of the diver.
That's some Batman stuff right there. I love that.
It's unbelievable. A lot of this stuff comes from the military. You know, they kind of invent it for their special ops or for their dive teams, and then, you know, over the years, it starts coming down in price.
That's amazing.
And then public safety teams can start affording it, or through grants can start purchasing some of this stuff to make their operation a little bit safer.
Now, what about like marine life, fishes, leeches, stuff like that? Has that ever come across as an issue while you're doing your dives?
Yeah. I don't have to deal with, you know, the great white shark kind of thing, but gosh, I've been, you know, I've been hit with snapping turtles. Snapping turtles have bit me, and fish have taken a chunk. I tell a story about this ninja fish. I was searching a pond.
Wait. Now, there's something called a ninja fish?
No, I made that up.
Oh, okay. I was like, I know a lot of fishermen. They've never caught a ninja fish before.
I was searching a farmer's pond for a murder weapon. I was on this grid pattern searching. I mean, it wasn't real deep. It was probably 5-6 foot deep, and it was a pretty soft, mucky bottom. And I'm looking for a sawed-off shotgun in total blackness. And I was wearing scuba back then, just a wetsuit and a normal scuba mask. And so the regulator's in my mouth, and really the only thing exposed was my lips. And so I'm working this pattern, and then out of the darkness, something bites my lip and starts pulling. And I can hear this skin ripping.
And Ninja fish. Underwater,
I'm swatting at this thing, and it must have been able to see me, because as my hand comes at it, it let go just in time to miss my hand, and then it would come and take another bite.
Oh, my God.
And I'm just sitting here fighting this thing, you know, getting bit, and I'm hearing, you know, my flesh getting torn, and you know, I'm thinking, you know, what do I do? I'm looking for this murder weapon, and I'm fighting this, you know, this thing in the blackness. So, you know, I knew I had to get out of there. So, you know, I searched and fought and searched and fought and searched and fought. Finally, I must have been out of his nest or whatever I was in, and so I keep working it, and you know, I'm thinking, what in the world, you know, happened? What was that thing? And so I moved my pattern over, but the bad part is I got to come back. And so I'm coming back through. I'm working this grid line. And so imagine a rope laying along the bottom, and every time you get to the other end, you move that end over, and then you work your way to the other end, you move that one over, and eventually that just starts working its way along the bottom.
Right.
And so here I am coming back, and honest to goodness, in my brain, I start hearing, the Jaws theme.
You're back in Ninja Fish's dojo.
I start hearing doo 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 doo, and I start telling myself, "Hey, all right, stop thinking this stuff." And all of a sudden, doo 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 doo, and I'm searching, and I'm thinking, "Okay, just stay calm. This thing, I'm out of its nest and out of the blackness." Whack! He hit me and started pulling, and I let out a yell, and I start fighting and searching, and I finally got out of his nest, and I was like, "Oh my goodness! I've never been attacked like this before." And
did you find out what it was?
It was all I could tell from, you know, I can't see it all, and the way my hand was trying to hit him, and every now and then it would touch me, other than his teeth. It felt like a small fish. It felt like some kind of small fish. And so I finished the dive. I found the weapon. I got out of the water. And these other divers are standing. When I got out of the water, they all started laughing. And I said, "What are you laughing at?" They said, "Man, go look at your face." I looked in the mirror, and my lips had these razor-sharp teeth bites, you know, all through.
Jesus Christ.
My upper and lower lip were just covered with these little bites, and blood was coming down my face onto my chin. And I mean, I was a mess. I went, "Oh my goodness."
It'd be funny if they said, "Go look at your face," and the fish was still attached to your lips.
I had blood dripping off of me, and I said, "Oh my goodness." And they asked me what happened. I said, "There's this little fish. And he beat the hell out of me." And, you know, if I could have surrendered, I would have surrendered. But I had to keep going. But, boy, did he got the best of me.
Mike, this has been one of the most fascinating interviews we've done. And I don't want to take up all your time. I could talk to you for hours. And maybe we'll have you back on in the future or something. But if people want to, like, I know we didn't even really get into UCI and I guess your group. I don't know if you're completely in charge of that or not. But if people want to go check you out or they hear your stories, I know you've been in a magazine before and different things like that. Where can they go?
You know, the best place to look me up is my website. I've got the largest public safety diving website in the world. It's ucidiver.com, and it connects you to you know, my email. But you can go on that website. It's not trying to sell you anything, or it's just full of information. So you can go on that website and learn about, you know, how to find a murder weapon, about rust, oxidation, electrolysis, how to bag a body, how to lift a car. You know, you can go on there and just learn all kinds of stuff. And one of the things we have on the website is to take the UCI challenge. And the challenge is you can't go through the website in one sitting because your butt won't last that long. It's that big of a website.
Well, when you say learn how to bag a body, like, I shouldn't read the article and then go try it, though, right?
No. It does take practice, and if you try to, you, like I mentioned earlier, you'd have your moment of truth. Is it something for you, or is it something not for you? But, you know, UCI, you know, that's what we specialize in. We specialize in teaching others how to conduct underwater criminal investigations. We also consult in cases, you know, tough cases other departments are dealing with. They can certainly call us, and we'll help them in any way we can. And but, you know, our main thing is teaching others how to do this, because, you know, just all the years I've been doing it, I've learned so much, and I've learned just from my missions. I learned from my students, and you're constantly learning. You never know everything. And so that's all I'm doing is sharing, you know, I'm sharing all this experience with others. And you know, it's a blessing to me, because I absolutely love it, and that's why I haven't retired. I still do it professionally, and I love meeting other folks and sharing this information and these techniques with other divers.
Mike, absolutely amazing. I got 1,000 more questions for you, but that's for another time. Wish you the best of luck, man, and thank you for giving us
pleasure.
A lot of time. And we will send you all the stuff when this is out. And thanks so much.
All right. Anything I can do, give me a holler.
Well, that was really cool.
That was fun.
That was really cool. Like, when you sent me that one, I'm like, whoa, like that's something that he's probably seen insane stuff. I'm yeah. sure the stuff he's seen is like horror movie times 10, you know?
I can't imagine how he did it in 35 years. It's bound to happen a few times. No,
the way he talks, it seems like it's frequent. Like, you know, they probably
well, even when we were scheduling him, he's like, you know, call me up. And I tried a few times. And I sent you an email. When I couldn't get a hold of him, I sent him an email. Hey, Mike, I just want to make sure you're still on board for the podcast. I don't want to bother you. And he just basically like, yeah, sorry. I was just coming off a murder case.
Yeah.
It happens to everybody.
Yeah. How'd you find him? How'd you find this guy?
It was just one of those. I always wanted to get like a diver on the show, something underwater. And we're going to get another guest in a few weeks. Yep. So always cross the fingers anytime somebody says yes. But, sorry, really, I can talk after 8:30 p.m. Sorry, there's possible another person that's, we'll talk about it later.
Yeah.
But, just random, so I mean, I was looking at divers, looking at sewage divers, just something unique, and just out of the blue, I'm like, yeah, I'm wondering if there's people who specifically are just criminal investigators, and I just started looking that up. It's popped up and
pretty awesome.
Boom. It was just, that's what it is. Just not only look at a level what you want to talk to, just, okay, let's go a little more specialized and make it more unique. And that was an awesome interview. All right. So coming up now, we're going to be talking with Tony Borglum.
He is the Tony Borglum.
Yes. And he is the owner of Drive a Tank.
Drive a Tank.
Yeah. It's a place out in Kasota, Minnesota. And they have a whole facility that allows you to book some time to drive a tank, shoot off a machine gun, and a bunch, crush some cars with a tank.
I've seen stuff like this on TV, like where you could get like German tanks and stuff like that. So, let's give him a call. Tony Borglum.
And he'll be on the road.
On the road again.
Hello.
Tony.
Hey.
Hey, it's Scott Brennan here and Mike Berlow here from Verbal Shenanigans.
Verbal Shenanigans, huh? So what are the shenanigans today?
Oh, you know.
Pretty crappy so far.
Yeah. We were trying to find Mike. Well, maybe you could help him find a job. We're going over some interesting jobs, and one of them was a snake milker. Well, he kind of had the same reaction.
Drive a tank does not approve of snake milking. It's official.
Golf ball retriever, face feeler, clown manager. Any of these interest you?
No, it depends. You know, here's the deal, though, is you get a job that everybody thinks they want, and then everybody wants to compete, and then all of a sudden I've been noticing that everybody wants to be the tank guy. And I think they do it for nothing. Where if you get the snake milker job, it probably pays average to good, and nobody is ever going to want to take it from you.
That's what I was just saying to Mike. I said, what does it matter what you do? If you're getting if you got a nice steady job, you're making money, like, who cares? I'll milk snakes. There was a coconut guy that just checked. All he did was pick coconuts that were going to fall on people at resorts. You know,
and it probably pays like $27 an hour, and it's got all kinds of benefits.
But anyway, Tony, where were we talking to you from today?
Minnesota. Well, I'm technically in Wisconsin, but I'm from Minnesota. We're just on a trip or looking at some stuff.
Nothing sounded shady about that, Tony.
The guy with the tank is looking at stuff.
We're hiding in Wisconsin.
We're actually in Wisconsin looking at stuff. Next question.
If anybody's listening, nothing fishy.
So, Tony, your business, it's called Drive a Tank, correct?
Yep.
When did this start? When did the idea start? And two, when did you actually get this to become a sustainable business?
Well, we got started in mid to early 2006. I was on a vacation. Actually, it was me and my dad went to England,
in search of a military vehicle, and we found a lot of places in England where you could drive tanks, and there was nobody in America doing it. So we figured if England would support 13 tank places, America ought to support one. We've been doing construction, heavy equipment contracting, and aggregate processing, and kind of the all those things that seem to get more and more competitive every year. So we thought a tank business would make a lot of sense. And, you know, it got profitable, or I shouldn't say profitable. It became sustainable very quickly, because when we tried to get going, we tried to do it at our shop in one of our aggregate processing facilities. We had about 30 acres, and our thought was, you know, maybe two weekends a month, we'd just have people come out and pay us to drive tanks around. It wasn't going to be anything super huge, you know, just a weekend deal, make a little extra cash. The guys in England were doing like 30 grand a weekend, you know, so it was a substantial amount of money. They were doing a lot of corporate stuff, which doesn't seem to be quite the, it's different here than it is in England anyway. But so we thought it was going to be a weekend deal, and our neighbors completely freaked out. They said, we don't want those kinds of people in town. They're going to blow up the school, and they're going to steal our children. And those kinds of people that are interested in tanks are terrible.
Two blown up schools later, and lots of dead kids. I showed that.
Needless to say, I'm the king of Minnesota right now. It's weird.
They only blew up City Hall. So they freaked out. And pretty soon, before I knew it, like, we had every news organization. We looked out the window one morning, and there was two of the TV news vans with the satellite antenna thingies on them in our yard. And there was like reporters from newspapers and magazines and all sorts of stuff. There was like a week period where all I did was interviews, and it was just unprecedented amount of press that just happened from the beginning. And we were just trying to get zoning permits. You know, we were thinking maybe we'd get going in a year. We bought vehicles that needed work that were affordable. We were thinking, look, we'll start doing the zoning stuff. We'll work on the vehicles in our spare time, and we'll get it all up and going. And maybe in a year or so, we'll be moving. Well, with that kind of press, I mean, we had to be going in like 2 months.
Oh, man. It seems like every time there's a controversy, it just equates to money. Easily.
Yeah, you know? That's it. I mean, it's like Henry Ford said, I don't care what they're saying about me as long as they're talking. You know, there's a ton of truth in that, because even if people don't like you, they're going to tell everybody about you, and there's going to be a few people they're going to cross to think it's a great idea. So it just works.
So when you're beginning this process, what exactly kind of like permits do you need to have to allow people to drive these vehicles and shoot guns and so forth?
You know, it's not too terribly complex. Importation of the vehicles is probably the most time consuming, I guess. You got to get a lot of, they're considered implements of war, so there's importation stuff that goes with it, and they got to make sure that the vehicles aren't U.S. government property, which most of our stuff is British and Russian, so that's not really an issue. You get your stuff imported, that takes a while. The approvals were taken at the time, about 6 months, then probably another 3 months of monkeying around with shipping and freight and whatnot. That wasn't terrible. The machine gun stuff is, you know, that's in most states, it's legal to own machine guns. You just have to do the proper paperwork and stuff. So again, that actually took the longest, was getting all the gun stuff sorted out. And then we built an indoor shooting range, which Minnesota's got a few guidelines. And as long as you kind of follow the guidelines, which are actually just the NRA guidelines that they put out, that engineers put together, Minnesota adopted that. So it's not terrible. The hardest part is getting everything to come together and work when you want it to, because tanks are like dogs and children. Like, they do something really impressive and really cool, and you want it to go and work, and you want to show the customers your friends, and then it just doesn't go. So that's where the biggest struggles really are, is in the equipment themselves.
Well, yeah, I was going to ask you, let's take a step back. obviously, to have the idea to run a business based on machines, did you have any kind of background with tanks or anything like that? Or were you just like, wow, no. It'd be cool? Like, who services these things?
I do. I've got one other full-time person. And I've got some other part-timers that come in. But, you know, for the most part, we've been doing construction, heavy equipment contracting for four generations.
Okay.
And we specialize in things that are built to do a job that you can't buy something for. So we've designed our own excavator attachments and farm drainage equipment. So it's just a diesel engine with tracks, you know. It's a really complicated one, because the military seems like they take what it could be and then they add twice as many gizmos to it. But at the end of the day, it's a lot of the same. And as long as you can, you know, just look at it and figure it out, it's just kind of trial and error. You know, if you do something and it breaks, you just don't do that again.
Hence the blown up school.
Yeah. Note to self.
Note to self. Aim left.
So, let me ask you. I mean, I'm looking at some of the packages here to talk about driving over cars, driving through houses. How much of an expense is that to be bringing in all these extra pieces to go with your business?
You know, that's where a lot of the logistics come in, is getting all that to come together. And it's like anybody can get a trailer, get a car, or call a junkyard and bring a car or two. But, you know, we're doing about 250 cars a year, so it really becomes like a thing, having to get them in, get them out, but then remain profitable. So I've got my own car transport that I've designed and built that's specific for hauling cars that are dead, because we load them with a forklift, so a regular car transport doesn't work, so you have to drive them on. So we've got our own rig, we haul our own cars, I pick them up out of different dealerships and things. When somebody trades in a junky car and the dealership doesn't want it, I pick it up, we prep it, drain all the fluids, anything that's dangerous like that, just like they would when they're going to crush them in a normal crusher. You drive the car over it. When we're done, we finish crushing the cars a little bit more just to get them tight together and ship them out, and they go to a shredder. So it's really just one more stop along the way, but it can be a real nightmare just getting everything orchestrated. You have to have enough cars on hand, and things like that can be tricky.
Yeah, I mean, you have drive a tank through a house as one of the options.
Yeah. Well,
that's the value
limit,
meal.
I was just assuming it was like people you didn't like that guy bullied me in fourth grade. Get him.
we try to keep the price up because there's only a population of 600 in Kasota, so we're afraid we'll run out of houses.
So what is that all about? Like, it's like mobile homes you buy, and then
it depends. We've done actual houses. I was actually walking down the street in Kasota one day, and the guy said, "Hey, we're gonna demolish my house. Why don't you drive a tank through it?" Oh, I said, "All right, I'll be here at 7 o'clock." I had a friend that bought a building site in the country, and it had a bunch of buildings and stuff on it. So I just he went through and got it all prepped to be demolished, you know. And before they took a piece of heavy equipment to it, we just charged people to drive tanks through it.
I feel like in New Jersey, you would need 700 permits, and everybody would have their hands in it. Uh-huh. And before you know it, it costs the same amount Giant Stadium to put up.
Isn't New Jersey the only state where you can't pump your own gas?
Yeah, yeah.
No, I think Oregon also has that law.
There's another one. There's two.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, we are.
We're a special kind of state.
Yeah, we're special because no matter what you do, everyone's got their hand in it. You want to put a 8x8 porch on your house, and it's like you got to call like 12 inspectors and the mason, and everyone's got to be approved.
They see you scratching the floor. It's like, no, that's termite damage. Let's bring in 12 more people.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, that's why we're in Kasota, because Kasota is one of those towns that everybody's got something that they maybe shouldn't. Like, there's a limit of 3 dogs, and the one neighbor has like 7 dogs. And I just, hey, when your dogs get loose in my yard, I just take them back over. I'm not telling anybody. You know,
like, everybody alone. Series, Kasota, Minnesota.
Kasota, Minnesota. Yeah, right. You know,
a little bit of Kentucky and Minnesota is what they say.
So let me ask you, like, you. Okay, so I book, I'm guessing like maybe your clientele might be bachelor parties or, you know, things like that, or weekend. So let's say I book a bachelor party there. What kind of experience am I getting? Am I, like, obviously you have different like levels and stuff like that, but what's the average like day? Like, we take a Saturday, we're coming to drive a tank. What are we looking at?
Yep. Our most common packages are going to be our 4-star package. We do the 3 stars sometimes for the bachelor party and corporate stuff. But a lot of the times our 4-star is the most common because that's the best bang for the buck. It'll start out, they all start out the same, no matter which package you pick. They start out with about a 15-minute safety briefing on just simple things that people, most of the time grown men, seem to forget when they are immersed in an environment with tanks, like, you know, use two hands on the ladder. Don't stick your fingers in the door. Don't stick your finger in an electrical outlet.
Berlo, you cannot drive a tank.
Yeah, all the real basic stuff. We go through that. Just make sure everybody's, you know, get them calmed down. And then we go through about a 30-minute presentation on the vehicles they'll be driving and the history of tanks, because it's important to back up and understand what a tank is so that you can appreciate, you know, the things that they've been used for and the right. people that operate them. And it's important to have a good background, and driving means so much more when you understand everything about the vehicle and the history of them. And then we typically, depending on the group size, we'll split up into multiple groups. So half of the group would go down to our forward operating base and they'd start their driving experience there. The other half would stay up by the range and they'd do their machine gun shooting. If you went down to the FOB and you were going to start driving tanks, with a 4-star package, for example, you'd start out driving the FV-433 Abbott SPG, which it looks like a tank. Most people think it's a tank, but technically it's a self-propelled gun. And the reason we utilize that vehicle is because it's affordable to operate and it was built with a sustainable lifespan. You drive that with your head out, and that gives you a feel. You'll drive that on our mile-long course. It's purpose-designed with hills and slopes and varying terrain. We've got about 40 feet of terrain variations, and we're through the woods and things. We've got some mud holes. You get an experience with that, and then you come back, and you'll get out of the Abbott, and you'll get into an FV-432 APC, which is an armored personnel carrier designed to haul people. But we use that vehicle for periscope driving, because obviously you can't drive around a tank with your head sticking out. So you close up all the hatches and you have this tiny little periscope to look out, and you have to try to maneuver the purpose-built course with that vehicle. And that's extremely difficult. It's almost impossible to do without making a mistake. But that's the environment that you'd be in a real combat situation. Now, that's hopefully as close as anybody ever gets to real life tank combat.
So many wars were lost from people just sticking their heads out and all doing lookout.
Yeah, the Polish tanks.
Yeah.
Polish tanks.
Those wars don't last long.
There's been a few. You know, when the periscopes get fogged up, you don't have much of a choice. It's just one of those things.
So when you get these groups, what do you see more of? The like crazy guy, like, oh my god, I'm gonna drive a tank, and it takes them forever to figure out how to go 2 feet forward, or like the older ladies, like, oh, I don't know if I could do this, and just starts demolishing everything and just going yeehaw.
You know, there's a little bit of each. We do have, like you said, the people that are afraid, don't think they can do it, but with our instructors, it's pretty easy to figure out, you know, and get the hang of it. Most of our customers are there because they really want to be. I mean, they're passionate. A lot of our customers are out of state or even out of country, so they really want to be there, and they're trying as hard as they can. And for the most part, everybody does really well. You get a few people that want to impress their friends, and they usually do something stupid and crash and burn, and we pick on them the rest of the day. But not too terrible. For the most part, they're respectful of the equipment. They know that if they damage something, they're probably on the hook for it. So, you know, it's usually a pretty good group.
Now, let me ask you, like, I don't know the first thing about tanks. How do like, if you were to describe how tanks drive to the average person, is it foot pedals? Is it with your hands? Is it a shifter?
Well, there's a lot of variations, but the most common, the ones that we find are the easiest for the public to operate, and that's why we try to do the majority of our driving with them. They're basically very, very similar to an automobile. They've got a gas pedal, right. a shifter for an automatic transmission. So the driveline functions very, very similarly. But where it's different is, instead of a steering wheel, you've got two levers, which are steering brakes. So if you want to go right, you pull the right lever. It applies mm-hmm. the right brake on the right track. You move to the right. If you want to go left, you pull the left lever. You move to the left. If you want to stop, you pull them both. It's right. really that simple. Huh. So those are very intuitive.
Where do you see this business going? Can you see yourself expanding, going into other states, or you just like to stay local?
That's why they were in Wisconsin looking at things. They're invading them with the tanks to take over some of Lambeau Field to make it.
I hate Jake.
We're doing our reconnaissance for our preemptive artillery barrage.
Exactly.
Yeah. No, you know, I've always kind of been on the – I've always been curious of that myself. In one way, it's nice to stay in one place and really do a really good job at it. Like Disneyland, for example, you know, they've got two locations around the country. So they haven't gone to every town. They made something that's worth traveling to. So that's one approach. The biggest problem that I ran into with the tank stuff is – it's almost impossible to find 100% reliable vehicle. I mean, this stuff isn't like a new car. You're running stuff that's 50 plus years old. The government got rid of it, and it's the hand-me-down system. So when it starts out, it's probably well taken care of. By the time it gets to the bottom where it gets sold or surplused, it's just been beat. It's like the car that you bought and it was super awesome, and then pretty soon you gave it to your kids and they just trashed you when they were 16. So that's really what we're working with. So reliability is the key. And I'm actually looking right now at purchasing some vehicles, and then we'll completely rebuild them from the ground up. We'll probably redesign a lot of the entire drive line with commercially available parts and kind of design a vehicle that'll give the tank experience, but be built from components that are affordable to operate and sustainable is really the key, because we don't know what the surplus market could bring for parts.
Right.
You know, one day tracks are available and the next day they're not. So it's a real tough thing to build a large business based on surplus parts that might not exist tomorrow.
Yeah, I was going to ask you the process of like buying a tank. Like you said, the government gave them, like, so does the government own them for X amount of time and then they're released to the public, or how does that work?
Typically, you know, the United States government has never sold or surplus or had a program for tanks. There's some American tanks in private hands and they are legal to own, but they're very, very limited because there was never a large volume to it. Very expensive. Typically, you can expect to spend at least $500,000 on an American tank. And that's part of what makes it. Yeah, that's what makes it difficult to, you know, to afford to let people drive the thing. So most of the stuff we stick with is either British or Russian design. You know, they come out of the Czech Republic or Poland or East Germany, some other country that was, you know, that worked with Russia at one time. They'll have large piles of the vehicles. And a lot of the stuff is exactly that. The government, you know, they've used it for 20 years. It's maybe getting outdated or whatever the reason may be, just gotten old. You know, it got rebuilt once and then rebuilt again, and then they decided it's not worth rebuilding another time, so they'll sell it. Some vehicles are still being released by the British military, you know, pretty current stuff here and there, but it's, as the years go on, it seems like the stuff that's getting sold is becoming less and less and less. The Brits really don't sell anything with a gun on it any longer. It's basically just armored personnel carriers and engineering vehicles. So
do you see that as a threat to your business, like now that you see things not being sold as much?
Yes and no. One benefit is it does increase the value of the vehicles.
Right.
So it does increase the barrier to entry to anybody else that might want to try it. Plus, gotcha. Eventually, my vehicles have gone up substantially in the last 10 years we've been doing this. So maybe at one time, I think it might get to the point where it's like, look, guys, for what somebody is willing to pay to drive it, it doesn't make sense to let somebody drive it. So either the prices will go up for driving, or my vehicles will just be sold off to collectors in that manner. It's really just kind of one of those. That's the problem with the surplus world. You just never know. I mean, tomorrow, the Germans might get rid of 1,000 Leopard tanks, and all of a sudden Leopard tanks will be worth $20,000. Or we may never see another tank get surplus, you know, again, and the only ones we'll be able to buy are the ones that are in private hands, and that's kind of the risk you take.
One more question. What's your favorite tank on your lot to drive, and why?
Oh, man, it depends on the day. You know, if it's like a Saturday night, it's a Russian tank, the T-54 probably. It's a 38-liter V12 with a manual transmission. Everything on it is super simple and robust and makes lots of clunking and banging noises, and it smokes, and it's just a mean machine. But if it was Sunday afternoon, I think the Sherman would probably be the vehicle. It's a lot more comfortable to drive. It seems like it flows. It's a lot smoother operating. You know, but if you wanted to crush a car, you really need a chieftain for that.
So that's like an SUV type of vehicle right there.
Yeah, you got it.
Yeah, when you want lay to go back, to the got the theater. Kids in the back, crushing cars, you know. Do what you got to do.
That's it.
So I guess before we get out of here, if people like are interested in this and actually think this is a possible option for them, or on the other hand, they just want to look at your site or whatnot and see what this is all about, what can they do? I mean, just go to the website and check it out, or can they talk to you, or how's that work?
Yep, they can. If they just want to look around, check out our vehicles, they can check out driveatank.com and go to our armory page, take a look at that. If they think after looking at the vehicles, they need to drive them. They can check out the packages page. And if they have any questions, they can give us a call anytime at 507-931-7385.
And now, is this something that if people do ever get interested in, should reserve well ahead of time?
Yeah, our June dates, you know, basically I always tell people anytime school gets out, you want to be booked at least a month in advance.
Gotcha.
You might be able to get in the day before, but it's tough to guarantee it. So if you're doing a lot of traveling, you got to book flights, it's good to book a month in advance.
Awesome, man. We definitely wish you the best of luck with the business. And maybe one day me and Burlo will get out there and drive a tank when we're, when we just happen to be passing by. What is it? Kinsoda? Is that it?
Kinsoda.
Kinsoda, Minnesota. Yeah. But thanks so much for giving us a few minutes, man.
No problem. Thank you.
Very nice.
Drive a tank, bro.
Yeah. Why not? They're out there.
That. The only thing I ever like remember even close to that was I remember down like I think it was like Wildwood, like in like the shore towns, used to have like the boats, and like it would, two people would drive, and one would drive and one would shoot at the top.
Those.
But it would shoot like tennis balls, but out of like the
I've done those.
And then like you'd be getting hit, and then like they have like little sensors in there, and you get hit a lot, like, like you were going down. That's the only thing I can like kind of compare that to.
Easily, yeah.
Okay. And as far, the only other experience was when I rode that horse in the ocean. That's like as far as like, I did something crazy like that.
I told you should have brought your machine gun while doing it.
They wouldn't let it on the plane. But, well, Mike Berlo, we are back. You know, we only did 100 interviews tonight.
Yeah, it felt like that.
Yeah, we backed up a lot of interviews tonight.
Yeah.
We are now officially back into the backed up in the drain.
This will come out around August 2018.
Yeah. We are where we tried to avoid for a while, but overall a very fun episode.
Yeah.
You know what?
Definitely diverse.
You know what? I'm not even going to go into what I was going to get into. Let's just get the hell out of here, guys. Brother, anything to promote?
I'll promote my brother's business, Extreme Commercial Cleaning LLC. He's based out of Sharpsburg, Georgia.
Sharpsburg. Oh, I thought you said Sharpsburg.
No, that's the uglier part of Georgia right there. Mm-hmm. But he has his own cleaning service. He does industrial and commercial business industries. Been doing this for over 7 years. For more information, call his number, 678-656-8372.
All right, and I'm going to promote, we are back at Table 42 again in June 4th with the one and only, my favorite, Mark Riccadonna.
Oh, very nice.
Who is Mark Riccadonna, and then Mike Ciccoli and Aaron McGuire opening up for
Triple Redhead.
Yeah, Triple Ginger Show. We're giving out sunblock on the way in.
Ricky, he's got to dye that thing.
Yeah, Mark's a crusher. Tickets are $35 for dinner and food on a Sunday night. There's nothing else better to do, so come on out to that. But, yeah, guys, the best thing you can do for us is, if you like this, give it a like on Facebook or Instagram. But the best thing you could do is share it with someone. That's the physical thing you can do.
Exactly.
You like this, send it to somebody. Hey, I think you might like this. Send it to your dad, your mom, your niece, whatever you got to do.
Yeah, you're at a funeral, got nothing to do, show some people something.
100%. So, yeah, that's the best thing you can do. But you could also follow us on Instagram at Verbal Shenanigans and on Twitter at VS Comedy. Other than that, I guess that's really it, guys. I hope you enjoyed both.
Scott, I have 6 more people we have to interview today.
I got to figure out how we squeeze them into the next couple weeks. There might be 2 episodes in 1
Happy
week
coming
up. Yeah. Happy Mother's Day and New Year. But anyway, I guess that's really it, guys. Life is funny. Laugh at it. Keep doing it. You're back. Bye-bye.
Later.